eat or be eaten. Haha. All of us living things love to eat, but hate being eaten. And so when something threatens to eat us, we resist. This elemental fact of life along the food chain leads us to ask, which population can best defend itself, diverse or uniform?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,095th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Geneva who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Quick question for you.
Yes.
Which kind of population do you think can best withstand threats from its enemies? Those that are uniform, like North Korea, China, or those that are diverse, like the United States?
Great question. You know, I could see either way, but off the top, I would say uniformity would probably prevail.
Ooh. Well, let's turn to our university students. Olivia, what do you think?
I'd have to go with diversity, Team America, all the way.
All the way? Sarah?
I would have to say the same, America.
Same?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2-1 against you, Jason. Well, folks, this from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Well, in our country, said Alice, still panting a little, you generally get to somewhere else if you can run very fast for a long time, as we have been running. A slow sort of country, said the Queen. Now here you see, it takes all of the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. To shift metaphors, as does plant ecologist Andy Dyer in his book, Chasing the Red Queen, consider the fox and the hare. The fox wants to catch a rabbit, need it. Not wanting to be eaten, all the rabbits run for it. The rabbits that can't run fast enough are caught and eaten, and that's the end of slow rabbits. But now the fox must run faster to catch faster rabbits, and if it doesn't, that will be the end of the slow fox. The race is on to eat or be eaten, and being in the race, we are all have the means to raise our we all look for the means to raise our resistance so that we can run twice as fast just to stay in the same place, so to speak. And so to stay the race as long as possible, we ask which population can best resist threats, those that are uniform or those that are diverse. And who better to ask than the author of Chasing the Red Queen himself, Andy Dyer, who is a professor of plant ecology at the University of South Carolina. Andy, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be back.
Yeah, good to be back. When we last talked, way back there in Food Chain number 1008, we talked about chasing the Red Queen and the importance of genetic diversity, and you responded, you know, it would be interesting to talk about, focus on genetic variation in resisting pests and diseases with respect to plants, and, you know, over the last few months, the entire population of the United States, it seems, has been talking about raising the resistance. So I thought, what a perfect time to check in with Andy and revisit our conversation about resistance. And so here we are. And you also mentioned the an interesting book that I have not been able to get, Insect Resistance in Crop Plants by Reginald Painter, published way back in 1951. So I guess that's where we're going to pick up today. We're going to go looking for ways to raise our resistance. Now, as a college professor, you're a teaching professor, right?
Absolutely. That's my primary function at the University of South Carolina in Aiken.
And I noticed that most of the students there who give you reviews give you great reviews, which to me means that you're a good storyteller. How did you come up with using the story of Lewis Carroll's Alice Through the Looking Glass to talk about this notion of running faster, just to stay in one place?
Well, I borrowed the idea. It originally started with people who studied parasites and their hosts, because, of course, all hosts are going to try to resist the parasite. But then if the parasite's going to be a successful parasite, it has to resist whatever the host is doing to stop it from being infected. And so there's this back and forth game, evolutionary game that's played. And they chose to use the Red Queen concept to sort of describe that. But it's also really ultimately came from the idea of the evolutionary arms race, which preceded the Red Queen concept. And that's the evolutionary biology aspect.
And by that, you mean evolutionary arms race. You mean we, the people, and have to keep up with the neighbors who have bigger tanks than we do. We have to build a bigger tank.
We always have to have a slightly bigger tank, yeah.
Always have to have a slightly bigger tank or you're going to be in big trouble. Well, okay. The race is on. Does this race apply to all things that are living?
It really does.
I mean, can't we get out of it somehow? I don't want to race.
Well, humans...
I just want to be friends with everybody.
Humans are in somewhat of a different boat than the rest of the world, I would say. Here's a basic problem in all organisms, and that is, in order to adapt to the stresses of the environment, it's necessary to produce the next generation, because it's the next generation that's going to carry the genetics for resistance better than this generation, because this generation is subjected to the stress. This generation is going to die in large numbers, but the next generation might not, because it has the genetic tools, for instance, to resist that stress.
They've got the messages, right?
Yeah. What that means is that whoever can produce the next generation the fastest tends to adapt the fastest. Well, humans are at a bit of a disadvantage because what are we, 15, 20 years per generation?
Yeah.
And if it takes 50, 100 generations to really have a good adaptation move through a population, we're talking about 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 years. We don't adapt very fast. So we have to use our brains to get around these problems.
Mm-hmm. Bacteria, on the other hand, that would love
bacteria
to eat us.
Yes, can do it in a week, maybe less. Yeah.
So
there's a fascinating video from Harvard, I think Harvard Medical School, that shows bacteria adapting to 1,000 times normal antibiotic doses in 10 days.
1,000 times in 10 days?
They step it up from 1 to 10 to 100 to 1,000 times the dose, but within the space of 10 days, completely non-resistant bacteria become resistant to 1,000 times in a regular dose. It's a fascinating video that you can look up on.
So the rule is those that adapt, those that procreate the fastest have the greatest opportunity to survive. And those that that procreate the slowest are at a great disadvantage.
Sure. And that's why large animals tend to go extinct faster than small animals. And that would mean that predators, which are generally larger animals, are more at risk of extinction than herbivores, which are more at risk of extinction than, say, insects. Mm-hmm. We're always chasing the smaller animals. The smaller animals are at the bottom of the food chain. They must adapt quickly or they will disappear.
And thus the fox and the hare.
You're right. Right, indeed.
And do students react favorably to stories? Do they like hearing stories? You know, one of the things I note about them, I have two college students here and they're both taking notes. But in the comments I read about you, your college students say, gosh, you don't have to take a lot of notes. You can just sit back and listen, and it's fun.
Well, if they can remember the stories. But I use the stories as analogies for the science. So if the concept is fairly complex, then I usually have to come up with one or two analogies that are perhaps more relevant to everyday life. And if I can do that and it sticks in their mind, then I hope that they can then turn around and explain the original concept to me because they have a reference point to use to remember it.
Well, I guess I'd like to start off with this whole notion of resistance by going back to, you know, the origins of agriculture. And we selected some seeds from the wild grasses and started the process of turning them into domestic grasses and thus feed ourselves without having to run around and chase critters, right?
Well, yeah, the origins of agriculture are also the origins of our civilizations, because they allowed us to stay in one place and not follow the seasons and hunt for food and go wherever it was growing. We could grow it ourselves. So it was an important turning point in human history.
And from that, we made the switch from natural selection to cultural selection, and thus, as you say, started our civilization. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Professor Andy Dyer, who is a professor of biology at University of South Carolina and author of Chasing the Red Queen. Today we're going to be learning what we can about raising the resistance to those that would like to eat us, and there are lots of them. Food Chain Radio, 831-479-1080. Right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it seems to me like the history of our agriculture has been that of taking the many and turning them into the few. We took the native grasses of the Golden Triangle in the Middle East and picked from them, and we selected those that we thought would be the best, and we planted them, and we took from that and selected the best and so on down through the millenniums. And here we are with modern strains of wheat. But there are a lot of modern strains of wheat anymore because we have selected and selected and selected. Am I close to the truth there, Andy?
You're close. I think so. We've not just selected those particular varieties, but we've ignored all of the rest at the same time. So we found one we really liked, and we sort of ignored the others because they weren't, we weren't working with them, or they weren't behaving the way we wanted them to behave.
And thus, we take their genes and put them in the garbage can, and that's that, right?
Well, I could use as an example potatoes. There are about 4,000 varieties of the potato from mostly South America. We grow 90% of our potatoes in the United States, one variety. And if you went to a typical grocery store right now, you might find three, maybe four varieties. The one potato that's grown most, of course, is the McDonald's French fry potato.
And there it is.
That's what drives the market, and the other is russet potatoes.
So as we've gone through history and selected from those that would best suit our needs at the time, we have fewer and fewer and fewer potatoes and everything else when it gets right down to it. And then we end up in a situation like that experienced by Ireland when it has one kind of potato. And what happened then?
Exactly. The Irish potato blight, 1845. And that potato was certainly not native to Ireland. It was brought there by Christopher Columbus, of all people, to Europe, and was considered an inferior sort of food. Wealthy people didn't like to eat things that grew out of the ground, but it was okay to give to the peasants. The thing is, the population of Ireland went from 4 million to 8 million.
On potatoes.
And then when that blight hit, it went from 8 million back down to about, I don't remember the exact numbers, 5 million? About a million people died, about a million people left for America and other places, and then the population generally dwindled. And it has just come back.
It just came back from that potato blight of 1840s?
the population of Ireland has rebounded to about where it was. But you're absolutely right. The issue was that there was one kind of potato being grown, and there was a blight that came along, and of course every single potato in the country was susceptible to it.
But in when times were good, that one potato was the best potato, right? And that's kind of what we have today, where we have so few crops, but the ones that are really good right now.
Well, we've made them really good. They do what we want them to do. We've bred them and manipulated them to do exactly what we want under the conditions that we are growing them. And that would be high fertilizer, mm-hmm. No competition with weeds, as few insects as possible. We create an ideal situation for a plant to grow, and I think any plant would do well. The ones that we've chosen not only do well, but they only do well under those conditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, forever, for 10,000 years, we've selected via what we call cultural selection. We look at a plant and think, this is the best plant, so I'm taking it and allowing it to procreate, and the others are gone. But now we've come to a new age in which we have now have the ability to go into the genetic code of a plant and invent our own. How is that having, what kind of impact is that having on genetic diversity and uniformity?
Well, I think most of those where we're crossing two kinds of plants, making hybrids, creating new plants, those are fairly small markets. The manipulating the genetics in the sense of genetic modification is the direction that I would say most commodity crops are going.
Mm-hmm. Corn and soy.
Sure. Not so much our food crops, although they are getting to that point. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more and more of those pop up, as in the new apples and things
new
like
apples,
that.
New apples,
right. But I don't know that we're inventing new things. We're mostly modifying existing things.
Isn't that kind of inventing them, though, when you take a gene from one species and put it into another species and kind of creating a new species?
Oh, I would agree with you in the sense that what you've got is not the same as what you had.
Right.
It's definitely different. Although these cultivars are so genetically weak to begin with, they're so simplified, they lack any genetic diversity whatsoever. We have bred out of them the characteristics that help them live in the wild, because we don't like those characteristics. They interfere with production. The plants, if a plant is producing all of those compounds that are not necessary for, say, making a tomato, then that's energy wasted as far as we're concerned. So we want to breed plants that send all of that energy into producing the thing that we want to harvest. So fruit or seeds or leaves or whatever. And we want them to stop trying to do other things that interfere with that process.
Mm-hmm.
The result is a plant that doesn't behave as it should in a natural situation.
And probably wouldn't know what to do in a natural situation, because agriculture is not natural.
It would be like throwing us out into the wilderness with no clothes and no food, yes.
No fun. So with respect to, I'd like to turn to, you know, the biotech industry, and what they are able to do with crops is kind of amazing if you think about it. One farmer can now grow 1,000 acres of plants with no pests or no weeds. That's a miraculous stuff. But in that, have they not, by necessity, reduced the genetic variation of just about everything to a very, very, very narrow range, because that's how they own the plant. They patent it, and it has to be unique to patent it. What impact does that have on diversity?
Well, the crops you're referring to, which are typically the commodity crops, have genetic variation of exactly zero. There is one genotype. That genotype has been patented, and that's been allowed by the patenting of life decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And what but the the biotech companies aren't patenting the plant. They're patenting just that one genotype, and they're producing millions and millions and millions of seeds, and they sell that seed of that single genotype. And so these monocultures, these vast monocultures, hundreds of thousands of acres, not hundreds of thousands, but of these commodity crops have no genetic variation whatsoever. They absolutely must be defended by humans because they're incapable of doing it themselves. So either we apply chemicals to protect them, we are the predators of those insects, or we put the capacity to defend themselves into the plant. But it's that capacity is usually just to defend itself from one thing. One or maybe a couple things, and not from the entire world.
And a good example of that would be the Bacillus thuringiensis pesticide that we infuse in the GMO crops. And
yes, and it's a useful protein. It's derived from bacterium, and I listened to your talk before with your GMO talk from a few months ago, and that was absolutely right, that that's what it does. It destroys the digestive system of the insects, and right, so you have a tool. Great. Yeah. It's a single tool for a single problem, and that is, for me, more of the problem with simplification in farming. It's not just genetics. It's using single tools for single problems, or using a single tool like glyphosate for 100 problems.
Okay, so we're going to take that and pick it up when we get back. But my question for you is, aren't we putting ourselves in the same place the Irish did with their potato? Food Chain Radio program. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we are back. And today we're talking about raising the resistance. That seems to be in the news. Everybody's running around raising the resistance. So that's our conversation today. What exactly can we do to raise the resistance? One thing we can do is we can look at agriculture, plant agriculture, because things change quite rapidly there in the plant kingdom. And we are changing things quite rapidly there. What impact are those changes having on the plant's ability to resist all that they must resist, and they must resist a lot? And so we're come to this notion of the potatoes in Ireland in the potato famine of 1844. It seems like they had everything figured out at the time. Olivia?
Yeah, hi, Professor. I would like to play devil's advocate. I'm wondering if this is about production and about genetic survival. If we perfect, you know, this gene formula to and contrive it to our will and make it how we want it to be, is that necessarily a bad thing that we're manipulating it to our human needs, as long as the risk for like the potato famine is minimal?
Yeah, and didn't the Irish have it all figured out? Andy?
Well, yeah, did they have it figured out? I think they were doing what they could to survive.
Which is what we all do, right?
Ireland was a relatively poor country, part of the United Kingdom, I suppose, but not one that was wealthy at all. I think the problem that we have with manipulating crops to bending them to our will, making them do the things we want, is that we've gone more and more toward what I call technological solutions to biological problems. And technological solutions will inevitably fail. Every pesticide, every herbicide, every insecticide will fail if it hasn't already.
Why?
Biology can't trump all of those technological solutions, because biology can adapt to changes in the environment. Any stress, any change in the environment is something, if it causes mortality in the organism, for insects, for instance, if a toxin causes mortality, the survivors will be the ones that can resist or tolerate that stress. So they will pass on their genes to the next generation. If that stress is a technological stress, like a pesticide, it is not capable of adapting to the adaptation in the insect. So there's no Red Queen race with technology. It has to be replaced, and it can only be replaced by us. So that means that
let's clarify that a little bit. It must be replaced. It can't adapt because it's just a technology. It's just a fix. It's like replacing a tire on a car. When the tire goes flat, you have to fix it or you have to replace it. You have to change it.
The car isn't regrowing a tire. New tires or repairing itself after a long trip or something like that. It requires an intervention from humans to change the technology. So biology can always overcome technology because technology doesn't adapt to the situation. So as we simplify crops, we are influencing their ability to resist, to adapt, to change as conditions change. And so they become more of a technological accomplishment on our part and less of a biological entity that's part of an ecosystem, that is the farming ecosystem. And they lack the ability to roll with the punches.
Hmm. You know what? It sounds to me like you're pointing us in the direction of we have to assume responsibility for these things because we have taken away their ability to respond themselves.
Well, I think that's agriculture, yes. Now, the question I think that comes to mind for me the most is there a way of growing food that doesn't diminish the ability of the plants to defend themselves from their enemies? And that's what we've gotten farther and farther away from as we've gotten more and more into inbred and genetically modified crops.
You're going to take us way back to insect resistance in crop plants by Reginald Painter, published in 1951. Are you telling me a book published in 1951 has some relevance today?
I think it's an amazing book. He was commenting in 1951 that already this pesticide resistance they were seeing in DDT, among other things, was absolutely predictable. But the crop plants with a lot of genetic diversity were able to resist insects. He was also noticing that insects that ate a diversity of crops were able to resist the pesticides. It was really some remarkable insights on his part. It's a hard book to find, but it's really remarkable that in 1951 he was making those observations.
One of my favorite books is Farmers of 40 Centuries by F.H. King, which was published at the turn of the last century. And, of course, it was the story of F.H. King, the Secretary of Agriculture here in the United States, going to China to teach the Chinese how to use modern technology. And once he sees the size of their production facilities, he realized that everything we were doing made absolutely no sense in that situation. So I guess some of those things that are dated don't go out of date. And one of them would be the notion that you can grow plants that have the innate strength and ability to resist, and that you can raise their resistance by improving how you raise them. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, I am. Now, we all understand why we've done what we've done. Modern agriculture is our way of increasing efficiency, productivity. Everything, all the crop matures uniformly. Everything has the same flavor. It only has to be harvested once. You know, all of those things that lead to high production and efficiency.
So this is
kind of contrary to the way nature works, but that's what we've been pushing toward.
So isn't that the strength of uniformity then? Is that it's something that I guess you can industrialize it.
Right. If that's what you want, then there's an absolute strength there. Unfortunately, it is a biological system, and we're attempting to turn it into, as you say, an industrialized mechanical technological system, and the rest of the world is not going to fall in line with that. The rest of the world still sees that plant as food. Increasingly incapable of defending itself.
Yeah. So when we take the innate genetic intelligence of a plant and refine it down to the point where it must exist within the production system that we design, then we become, I guess, God.
Oh, we're the caretakers.
And therefore we're responsible for everything. And therefore
we have to be.
Yeah, and therefore we have to keep up with this race where we have to run twice as fast to stay in the same place. Right?
We have to do the running because the plant cannot. Yes, we're running for the plant, I suppose you could say.
And we always have to run twice as fast.
Well, that's a problem, though. We can't anticipate where the next problem's coming from. So my argument would be we're not racing to stay ahead. We're racing to keep up. The natural world is already ahead of us, and that's why we're in a panic most of the time trying to find a new herbicide or pesticide or some sort of genetic trick to help our plants continue producing at the level we've got them producing at. We're in trouble. We're trying to catch up in a system that beats us every time we come up with a new gimmick or a new trick.
What to do? We'll find out when we get back. Do stay tuned. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I have a question for you out there. Which population do you think can best resist threats to its existence? Those populations that are uniform, like that of China and North Korea. Or those populations that are diverse, like that of the United States. Which population can best defend itself against threats? And I reckon that would be true with plants and other organisms as well. Is that a good assertion, Andy?
Oh, I think absolutely. Genetic variation in any population is absolutely necessary for the evolution of that population, for that population to adapt. There has to be some raw material there for natural selection to work with, and a genetically reduced or genetically thin population just may not have the necessary genes to deal with new stresses.
What lessons might we learn on how best to prepare our food for us to eat? We're in a situation where we have, you know, I think you're right, hundreds of thousands of acres of genetically modified corn and soybeans. Those foods are the base of our industrial food system. It seems to me like we're kind of in a situation where the Irish were in the 1840s. Everything is cooking along just great, but then all of a sudden, something new comes into the system and nobody knows what to do with it. Are we in that same situation?
I think that's exactly the problem. As long as nothing changes, we're fine. But that is...
not the nature of life, is it?
No, that's a fantasy. We've seen that, for instance, recently with honeybee hive collapse. Suddenly, something new in the environment came along, and honeybees were not capable of dealing with it. We didn't know what it was either, but we'd been cruising along for years, assuming that honeybees were a very stable sort of crop, a species.
They were taking good care of us, weren't they?
And we didn't pay much attention to them either. We didn't know anything about their sort of the microbiology of the hive and that sort of thing. They do their thing, and we're happy with it. It turns out we need to know what these things are up to and what makes them tick. Because as things change, we're going to have to be able to adjust. And by the way, we only have one honeybee. There is only one. So it's Apis mellifera, and it's not particularly genetically variable. And that creates a problem.
And that honeybee is analogous to the soybean crops out there in the field and the corn and everything else, where we use technology to reduce the genetic variation. And are we not now responsible for the honeybee?
Well,
because we have been responsible for making these changes to its environment.
We certainly are. We're responsible for those changes. There's no question about that. I think your analogy of the Irish potato is if we took a look at the Cavendish banana, I think we would you could understand better the situation we're putting ourselves in. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Cavendish, but the banana that we eat is a banana that we started eating in the 1950s because the previous banana was getting, which was the Gros Michel banana, was a wonderful banana, better than the one we have now, but there was a tropical fungus that was killing all the plants. And so we found this banana that was not affected by this fungus, and we grow that banana. But the thing is, that banana came from a single plant that was in a greenhouse and had been in a greenhouse since the 1800s in England, and it was a nice banana, and so everybody in the world now grows that banana, and that's the banana we
eat. It came from one plant in a greenhouse in England?
Yeah, because bananas don't make seeds. Yeah. They propagate clonally. They mm-hmm. just grow new shoots. And so there is zero genetic variation in the banana we market most widely. And now there is a fungus that is attacking that plant. There is no help for that plant. It's doomed. We have to find a new banana now. And we need to do it in the next decade or so. And that's the problem we're putting ourselves, that's the situation we find ourselves in as our soybeans and corn and there's really only two cultivars of cotton that are the upland cotton that we grow in this country. They're both patented. We are putting ourselves in a very precarious situation.
Well, what the heck do we do? I mean, if we're in it, we're putting ourselves in this situation. How do we get out of it?
Well, fortunately, there's some very active movements to bring back heirloom crops and move back toward polyculture instead of monoculture. You're familiar with Joel Salatin and what he does. He grows grass. He doesn't grow beef or chickens. He's farming the ecosystem. There's a terrific new short video called 100,000 Beating Hearts that's about a cattleman named Will Harris. He used to grow cows. Now he grows, all he thinks about is how to heal the land, how to improve the land. And he's gone from 700 head of cow to 100,000 sheep, goats, cows, chickens, a number of different birds. And they all live on exactly the same amount of land he had before. It's just that his ecosystem is healthy, and the caring capacity of the ecosystem is healthy because he's caring for the soil now instead of caring for the cows. He also doesn't use pesticides, fertilizer, or antibiotics.
Well, then there is a direction we can take. And when we get back from this break, we're going to ask the professor himself how we can all take that direction and have some fun doing it. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Andy Dyer, professor of biology, University of South Carolina, and author of Chasing That Red Queen. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, once again, this from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Well, in our country, said Alice, still panting a little, you generally get to get somewhere else if you can run very fast for a long time, as we have been doing. A slow sort of country, said the Queen. Now here, you see, it takes all of the running you can do just to stay in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. Well, Andy Dyer, you used that metaphor in Chasing the Red Queen. Is it possible for us to find a place in the world and in existence where we don't have to run twice as fast just to stay in the same place?
I think so, yes. I think there have been some good examples of farmers and ranchers who are using the system to help them rather than fighting it all the time. Because I think that modern agriculture is essentially a battle against nature. And in order to win that battle, we've done what we've been talking about to crops, and that actually weakens our ability to continue to win in that battle. So I think that it's important for us to think about how nature works and try to work according to those rules. I think of those as the rules of the game, sort of the evolutionary game. If we understand how insects adapt and what they adapt to, then we need to manipulate the system, not manipulate the crop. And we've gone, and you know this, we've gone towards simpler and simpler and simpler farming systems to the point where we've got dirt and a crop. and not very healthy dirt either. And
nothing. There's nothing in the dirt. It's just dirt.
Yeah, instead of soil, which is a very different thing. Farming dirt and farming soil are two very different things. Soil is about 50% air or pore space, and it's maybe even 25% living things. There's not that much dirt actually in it unless you get rid of all of the other living things. And so caring for the soil, I think, is step number one. We have to make the soil healthy, because I think a healthy soil produces healthy plants, and healthy plants are better able to survive.
If it isn't in the soil, it isn't in the plant, and if it's not in the plant, it's not in us.
That's right.
Well, so are you a heretic of agriculture?
Oh, I think agriculture is absolutely essential. I'm just, I don't know if you quite what you mean by heretic, but do I like modern agriculture?
Does modern agriculture look upon you as a heretic?
I think that as with say soil conservation scientists who tell farmers to grow a cover crop, don't till the soil, drill your seeds into the cover crop, flatten it and drill your seeds in, they look at them and say, well, what about the fertilizer? Aren't I supposed to apply that? And I say, no, we want to get you away from that. And you know, they'll scratch their head and say, I don't think you understand farming. Farming means, you know, doing it the way we've done it for the last 50, 60, 70 years. And I think that this we're trying to turn the corner on this and say, look, that's what we used to tell you, yes, but we've come to realize that that may not be the best way to grow plants.
Maybe those farmers of 40 centuries knew something that we need to know about the soil. Andy Dyer, you know, thank you so much for joining us from way out there in the University of South Carolina. Really appreciate it. Author of Chasing the Red Queen, and a fun read, folks. And thank you for coming back to the food chain. Always enjoy talking with you, Andy. And I want to thank you all out there for tuning in. I want you to remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.